You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Mein Kampf by Adolf Hitler.
Volume 2. The National Socialist Movement. There is another reason why the state must look ahead to our future and help aspiring talent. Especially in Germany, our intellectual classes are so isolated and fossilized that they have no living connection with those in the social classes beneath them. This has evil results in two ways. In the first place, the intellectuals have no understanding and no sympathy for the broad masses. Their connection to the people has been broken too long. They no longer have the necessary psychological understanding needed to relate to them. They have become strangers to their own people. Secondly, these upper-class intellectuals do not have the necessary strength of will. Strength of will is always weaker in intellectual social classes than in the primitive mass of the people. God knows we Germans have never lacked academic scientific education, but strong will and decisiveness have totally eluded us. The more intellectual our statesmen have become, the more deficient their accomplishments have become. The political preparations and military equipment for the First World War were inadequate. This was not because those who governed our people were insufficiently educated, but because they were overeducated, stuffed with knowledge and intelligence that they had no sound instinct and lacked energy and boldness. It was a catastrophe that our people had to defend themselves in this battle under a weakling philosopher chancellor. If instead a Bethmann Hollweg, we had a more forceful man of the people as a leader, the heroic blood of the infantry soldier would not have been shed in vain. In the same way, the excessive intellectual refinement of our leadership was the best ally for the revolutionary November criminals.
Bethmann Hollweg is Theobald von Bethmann Hollweg, Chancellor of the German Empire until 1917, who was viewed as a moderate.
By shamefully holding back the national budget which the people entrusted to them, instead of risking it in its entirety to build defences, these intellectuals themselves made the success of the Allies and the revolution possible. The Catholic Church is a splendid counterexample. The fact that its priests are unmarried forces it to draw the new generation of the clergy from the great masses of the people instead of from its own ranks. This significant effect of celibacy is not usually recognised. It is the reason for the incredibly vigorous strength in this ancient institution. Because the giant army of priests is constantly recruited from the lowest classes of the peoples, the church not only remains instinctively close to the emotional world of the people, but assures itself of the energy that is always available from the broad masses of the people. This accounts for the amazing youthfulness, intellectual adaptability, and iron strength of will in this giant beast. The new race-based state will make sure the educational system provides a constant supply of new blood from the lower social classes to the existing intellectual classes. It is the state's duty to carefully and thoroughly sift through the population and discover those of obvious innate talent and put them to work for society. State offices do not exist to provide posts for special social classes, but to accomplish the tasks they are given. That will only be possible if capable and strong-willed personalities are trained for services in these offices. This selection process is true for the intellectual leadership of the nation in every field, and for all those who take part in intellectual and moral leadership, not just the civil service. The greatness of a people is revealed by how well they succeed in training the most able minds for the fields that they are best suited to, and how they are put to work for the national community. If two nations of basic equal resources are competing, the one whose best talents are represented throughout its intellectual leadership will be victorious, and the one whose leadership is just one big common feeding trough for certain groups or social classes, which does not consider the natural ability of individual members, will be defeated. In our present-day world, this seems impossible. There will be immediate objections from some. If, for example, the son of a high state government official is expected to become a craftsman, simply because another son of a craftsman seems more capable as a civil servant than the official's son. That may be true given the present social status of manual labor. For that reason, the new race-based state will have to encourage a new attitude toward the idea of labor. Through centuries of education, it will have to break the bad habit of sneering at physical labor as a lowly occupation. The state will have to judge the individual man on how he contributes, not by the nature of his work, but by the form and excellence of his performance. This may seem shocking to an age in which the dullest bum newspaper writer is thought of more highly than the most intelligent precision mechanic, simply because the writer works with a pen. This incorrect evaluation is not part of our nature, but has been artificially taught. This attitude has not always existed. The present unnatural state of affairs results from the general diseased condition of our materialistic age. Every kind of work has two types of value: a purely material value and an ideal value. The material value lies in the practical importance of a job for the life of the community. The more the members of the nation benefit from someone's work, the higher the material value of that job. Consequently, this job's value is shown by how much someone is paid for his work. In contrast to this purely material value is the ideal one. The ideal value does not depend on the importance by material standards, but on the degree of its fundamental necessity. How important is the work to the country as a whole? Certainly, the material advantage of an invention to the country may be greater than that of an ordinary mason's assistant job, but society depends as much on the small service as it does on the great one. Society makes a concrete evaluation of a job's value to the community by varying the rate of pay. But society must establish that every worker is equal whenever each individual does his best in his own field, whatever that may be. The evaluation of a man depends on his contribution to the community and not on his wages. In a reasonable state where individuals are directed in their vocations, each must be assigned to the activity that suits his ability. In other words, able minds must be trained for the work they can best do. Ability, however, is not taught but born. It is a gift from nature, and not a developed skill that can be attributed to man. Consequently, one's social position should not force a job on the individual. His job should be determined by the abilities he was born with and by the education the community has provided to him. A man's value must be based on the way he handles the job he has been made responsible for by society. The vocation that an individual follows is not the purpose of his existence, but only the means to his livelihood. He should continue cultivating and refining himself to reach a higher level as a human being, but he can only do this within his cultural community, which must always rest on the foundation of a state. He must make his contribution to preserving this foundation. Nature has already decided the form of his contribution. All he must do is return to the national community zealously and honestly what it has given him. The man who does this earns the greatest esteem and the highest respect. A material reward may be given for achievements that are beneficial to society. However, the individual reward comes from the appreciation he receives, an appreciation that everyone who devotes what nature has given to him and returns what national community has trained him for back to the service of his nationality is entitled to. That means it is no longer shameful to be a good craftsman. But it is shameful to waste God's days and the nation's bread and butter as an incompetent state official. It will then be taken for granted that a man will not be assigned to a duty if he does not have the gifts for it from the start. Personal effectiveness in one's job is the sole standard that will determine his right to general participation and his right to participate in legal or civil affairs on an equal level. The present age is cutting its own throat. It introduces universal voting and chatters about equal rights, but cannot find any foundation for this equality. It sets a man's value based on how much he earns, which destroys the basis for the most noble equality that can possibly exist. Equality does not and cannot depend on individual achievement. Instead, equality exists only in the way everyone fulfills his obligations to the community. That is the only way natural chance can be eliminated in judging the value of a man, and the individual can be made the architect of his own importance. In the present age, when entire groups of people judge one another by their income, they are incapable of understanding this idea. But this is no reason for us to abandon the idea. On the contrary, the person who wants to heal this inwardly sick and rotten age must first gather the courage to expose the causes of the disease. The National Socialist movement must take this as its duty and go beyond any narrow-minded elitism to gather and sort out those people who are the willing forces in our own nationality, ones who are willing to champion a new world concept. There is no doubt that objections will be made, saying it is difficult to separate the opinion one has from the amount of pay, and therefore the lower esteem associated with physical labor comes from the lower rate of pay. This lower rate of pay means a man is less able to participate in the cultural wealth of his nation. This inability to improve his cultural knowledge damages the man's personal culture and has nothing to do with his work in itself. The most understandable reason that someone would find physical labor objectionable is because the lower pay necessarily means the cultural level of the manual laborer must be lower, and that in turn justifies the lower value people hold for manual labor. This idea is commonly believed to be true. Because of this, it will be necessary in the future to avoid excessive differentiation in wage scales. Let no one say that this would cause accomplishment to end as pay scales were equalized. It would be the saddest sign of an age's decay if higher intellectual achievement was only driven by the desire to receive higher pay. If this point of view had been the prevalent one in the world previously, mankind would be without its greatest scientific and cultural possessions. The greatest inventions, the greatest discoveries, the most revolutionary scientific work, and the most splendid monuments of human civilization were not given to the world out of a compulsion for money. On the contrary, their creation frequently represented a rejection of the earthly pleasures of wealth. It may be true that money has become the exclusive ruler of life today, but the time will come when man will kneel to higher gods again. Many things around us today may owe their existence to the desire for money and property, but there is also very little of it that mankind would truly be any poorer without. Another task of our movement is to work for the day when the individual will receive what he needs to live on, but at the same time will uphold the principle that man does not live exclusively for material pleasures. This will be illustrated in a wisely constructed universal pay scale that will allow every honest working man a respectable and decent existence as a human being and as a member of the nation. Don't let it be said that this perfect condition is an ideal that this world could never withstand in practice and would never actually achieve. We are not so simple as to believe that a perfect age can ever happen. But this does not relieve anyone of the obligation to fight against the faults we see, to overcome weaknesses in the system, and to strive for the ideal. Harsh reality will always limit what we seek to accomplish. For that very reason, man must do the best he can and aspire to reach the ultimate goal. Failures must not distract him from his purpose. for he cannot abandon a judicial system simply because errors slip through, and he would not condemn all medical science just because there is still sickness in spite of our best efforts. We must never fail to uphold the strength of an ideal. If anyone is faint-hearted at the thought of upholding ideals, I would like to remind him, especially if he has been a soldier, of a time when heroism was the most overpowering testimony to the strength of idealistic motives. Men did not die over concern for their daily bread, but for love of the fatherland, belief in its greatness, and national patriotism. When the German people abandoned these ideals to follow the practical promises of the revolution and exchanged the rifle for a knapsack, our people found themselves not in an earthly heaven, but rather in a purgatory of unending contempt and distress. This is why it is necessary to establish a faith in an idealistic Reich, to battle against the reckoning imposed by the present materialistic republic. Chapter 3. State member versus state citizen. The structure that is today erroneously called the state identifies only two kinds of men, citizens and aliens. Citizens are those who possess the right of citizenship either by birth or by later naturalization. Foreigners are those who enjoy the same right in another country. In some places, there are also comet-like beings that are considered stateless, who simply wander the universe. These are persons who have the honor not to belong to any of the present-day states and possess no right of citizenship anywhere. Today, the right of citizenship is acquired primarily by birth within the boundaries of a country. Race or membership in the nation plays no part at all. A Negro, who used to live in the German-protected territories and now has a residence in Germany, brings a German citizen into the world if he has a child, in the same way any Jewish, Polish, African or Asian child can be declared a German citizen. That is one kind of naturalization by birth within an extended territory, and there is another possibility for later naturalization by paperwork. There are various qualifications required to become naturalized like this. For example, the prospective candidate will preferably not be a burglar or a pimp. He will be politically safe, which is to say he is a harmless political fool. And finally, that he will not become a burden on his new national home. In the present materialistic age, this means he will not be a financial burden. In fact, if one is believed to be a potentially good taxpayer, his state citizenship can be rushed. Racial considerations play no part whatsoever. The whole process of acquiring citizenship is pretty much like joining an automobile club. A person sends in his application, it is checked and approved, and one fine day he is informed on a slip of paper that he has become a citizen. The information is even put in a humorous and joking manner. The applicant, who was previously a Zulu or Kaffir, is notified, "By these presented, you are now become a German citizen." Sick. This magic trick is accomplished by the signature of a state official. What heaven could not attempt one of these Theophrastus Paracelsus officials can do with a scribble of his hand?
Theophrastus Paracelsus was a Swiss alchemist, astrologer, physician in the 1500s, who travelled in Germany and was connected to Lutheranism. He is meant to be a magician in this reference, however he disliked that label.
One scratch of the pen and a Mongolian Wenceslaus is suddenly turned into a real German.
Mongolian Wenceslaus appears to refer to a Czech Saint Wenceslaus, but here means a Mongolian saint, not of the Germanic race.
No attention is paid to the race of one of these new citizens. His physical health is not even considered, though he may be crawling with syphilis. Nevertheless, to the modern state, he is welcome as a citizen, as long as he is not a financial burden or a political menace. Every year, these structures we call states absorb poisons which they can barely survive. The citizen is different from the alien because all public offices are open to the citizens, He may be required to serve in the military, and he is allowed to take part in elections. Those are his main benefits. The foreigner enjoys protection of personal rights and personal liberty, the same as a citizen, and sometimes even more. At least this is how it plays out in our present German Republic. I know that people will not enjoy hearing all this, but there is nothing more empty-headed and insane than our present naturalization law. Currently, there is one state that is making at least a feeble effort to create a better system. Of course, it is not our model German Republic where this good sense has taken hold, but in the United States of America. By excluding all immigrants who are unhealthy and outright refusing entry to certain races, the Americas are showing at least faint signs of a common attitude in the race-based nationalist state idea.
This refers to the American Immigration Acts of 1921 and 1924.
The race-based nationalist state divides its population into three classes: state citizens, subjects of the state, and foreigners. One becomes a state subject by simply being born in the state. State subject status does not entitle its possessor to hold public office or to be politically active, such as participating in elections, either actively or passively, nor running for office or voting. The race and original nationality of every state subject must be proven. The state subject is free at any time to relinquish his subject status and become a citizen of whichever country is his own. The foreigner is distinguished from the state subject by the fact that the foreigner already holds citizenship in a foreign state. The children who are state subjects of German nationality are required to go through the school system, which is established for every German. Through the school system, he undergoes the training to make him into a race-conscious and nationally aware member of the people. Then, when he leaves school, he has to go through the additional physical training prescribed by the state, and finally he enters the army. The army training is of a general nature. It will include every single German and provide training that will make him useful to the military based on his physical and intellectual abilities. On completion of his military duty, state citizenship is solemnly granted on the healthy young man of faultless character. This is the most valuable document of his entire earthly life. He then becomes a full state citizen and is able to enjoy all those rights and privileges. The state must make a sharp distinction between two groups of the people, the ones who support and maintain the existence and greatness of the state, and the ones who simply live here as gainfully employed elements within a state. When a person receives his certification of state citizenship, he must take a solemn oath to the national community and state. This oath must be a common bond that brings together all social classes. It must become a greater honor to be a street cleaner and a citizen of the Reich than to be a king in a foreign state who is not a citizen of the Reich. The state citizen is a privileged gentleman who enjoys advantages not available to the alien. The citizen is the master of the Reich. But this higher dignity comes with its obligations. The man without honor or character, the common criminal, or the traitor to the fatherland may have this honor taken away, at which time they become a mere state subject again. The German girl is a state subject and only becomes a citizen when she marries. Citizenship may, however, be granted to female German state subjects if they have independent careers. Chapter 4. Personality and the idea of the people's state. If the race-based National Socialist state achieves its main interest, the development and preservation of the human strength of the state, then it will not be enough to simply promote the racial aspects of society and then to educate society and finally prepare individuals for practical life. It will have to also make adjustments in its own organization so that it reflects the same values it promotes. It would be insane to judge man's value by his race and then turn around and declare war on the Marxist claim that all men are created equal, if one were not determined to follow through to the logical conclusion. Once we recognize how important the purity of blood is and the importance of race in ability, then the logical conclusion is that these tests must be applied to the individual person. Just as I must assess nations differently based on the races that fill them, I must assess the individual person within that national community race. The fact that a nation is not simply a nation carries over to the individual within a national community. The value of a nation varies based on those races in it, and the value of a man varies based on the racial elements within him. It's the same thing when we say a mind is not simply a mind, the same as any other. Even when the elements of blood are the same within a race, their qualities are subject to 1,000 subtle variations. The first thing we see from this understanding is what I would call the more crude realization. It is that we must promote the qualities found to be racially valuable within the national community and to encourage them to multiply. This task may be considered crude because it can be recognized and accomplished almost mechanically. However, it is more difficult to recognize the most valuable minds that have the intellectual and idealistic qualities needed by the community and to grant them the influence which is not merely given out due to a superior brain, but most importantly, granted based on their ability to be useful to the nation. This separation according to ability and capacity cannot be accomplished by unemotional, unthinking mechanical means. It will be part of the constant struggle that is decided through the daily labors of life. A world concept that rejects the idea of blind rule by democratic masses and gives the world to the best people, to the highest quality human beings, must obey the same noble principle it follows within its people, and make absolutely certain that the best minds become the leadership, and those great minds are the predominant influence over the people. This world concept does not build on the idea of majority, but rather on that of character. Anyone who today assumes that a race-based national socialist state is only differentiated from other states by emotionless qualities, such as better construction of its economic system, does not have the faintest idea what a world concept really is. If they think it is created through a better balance of wealth and poverty, or a greater voice in the economic process for the broad masses, or by more equal pay through the elimination of excessive wage differences, they have been blinded by the superficial aspects. Everything I have just described offers no security and does not guarantee our permanent survival. It offers even less of a claim to greatness. A people who become bogged down in these outward reforms would not have the slightest chance of victory in the struggle for the nation's existence. Any movement that believes balancing the social classes and promoting equal economics, though noble, are the sole core of its mission, will not produce any great results or any true reform of existing conditions. All of its activity eventually becomes wrapped in showiness and totally preoccupied with appearances without giving the people the inner preparation they need to finally overcome this, I say with certainty, those weaknesses we will suffer from today.
Tuned in to